This entire season of Retronauts is fully funded by listeners like you thanks to Patreon. If you'd like to find out how you can help and get episodes a week in advance, head on over to patreon.com/retronauts. Thanks and enjoy the show. This week on Retronauts, it's time to wake up and smell the ashes. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of Retronauts. I am your host this week, Bob Mackey, and today's episode is going to be all about Half-Life 2.
Isn't that retro now?
It's officially retro. It's more than 10 years old, so look out, everybody. Look at your aging hands and features, because we're all headed towards that old friend the grave, aren't we?
Oh, man, this might be this might be the first episode devoted to a game that I reviewed in my time in the press.
Well, first of all,
Who
are you, mysterious press person?
I'm the voice of Jeremy Parrish.
But where's the real Jeremy Parrish?
Sitting across from you.
Okay, I gotcha. Who else do we have here? A special guest who I just met 5 minutes ago. Instead of Jeremy.
Ah, yes. I'm Kevin Van Ord. And my voice and my body are both present in this room with you.
And Kevin, where might people know you from? Can you talk about where you've worked, or maybe some pieces you've written?
Sure. Well, I was at GameSpot for 9 years until August, at which point I decided to make the jump into game development instead. And now I work for Tryon Worlds, where I wrote for Devillion for a while and then moved over to the Atlas Reactor team.
Oh, wait,
so,
cool.
Yeah.
And I have Kevin on here because obviously he has a lot of credentials, but he's also a huge Half-Life 2 fan. And I will tell you, the Retronauts community failed me multiple times. I went through, and this is only because I didn't know Kevin, and I feel more comfortable reaching out to people who I do know to be on my show. But like, I reached out to maybe like 4 people before on Twitter, out of desperation. I was like, does somebody know about Half-Life 2 or want to talk about Half-Life 2? And our friend Jason Wilson, who was on the Baldur's Gate episode, told me to contact you, Kevin, and you were very friendly to someone you'd never met before, and you agree to be on our show. So thank you so much for coming down.
No, it's my pleasure. Yes. I could talk about that game for hours.
You are the savior of this episode. It could not just be me and Jeremy.
Aw, yes. I always wanted to be a savior.
It could, but it would be terrible.
So, yeah, it would not be very interesting. We would lose Patreon money. Yeah, like we like watch it go down as the episode went live. So I'm glad that didn't happen. So thank you so much, Kevin, for being on here. Let's talk about this game. Just to get things out of the way, you can crucify me for this if you want to, but I've never actually finished the original Half-Life. I feel like it has not aged super well, and so I won't be referencing that game a lot. Before we start off, do we want to talk about anything about Half-Life, just to get that out of the way, because I won't be talking about it much, like what it did for games, what's the importance of it compared to Half-Life 2. Is there anything we want to get out of the way first about the original Half-Life? 1998 was a really big year, and this is one of the big games of that year.
I mean, Half-Life convinced me that Valve doesn't like me personally, because they kept denying me the opportunity to play the game on platforms I owned.
Oh.
First they said, oh yeah, no, it's not coming to Macintosh. Then they said, oh yeah, we're going to do a Dreamcast version. No, just kidding, we're not. So I take it kind of personally.
So
still a good game though.
It was a game expressly made to annoy Jeremy Parrish.
It was.
Kevin, how did you feel about the original Half-Life? What do you think is the value of that game before we move on to part two?
Well, I think there are really two big ones. One is the first-person narrative aspect of Half-Life. In this case, you know, not cutting away to cutscenes and everything from a first-person point of view, you being talked to as both the player and as Gordon Freeman. Just the seamlessness of narrative and gameplay was a really big part of Half-Life 1. The other part, of course, is Counter-Strike.
Of course,
but that's probably another conversation.
Yes, one that I can't be on because I know nothing about it. But I'm glad we talked about it for at least a minute, and I'm sorry if you want us to give more credit to Half-Life. But everything Half-Life did, I feel like Half-Life 2 does better in a way that's aged a lot better. And that came from an insane development period, which I do want to talk about. Now, I read Kevin has a great piece on Half-Life 2 on GameSpot currently. What is that piece called again, Kevin?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
That's okay. That was not a pop quiz. You can just Google Kevin's name and Half-Life 2 and you'll find
it'll come up somehow.
I heartily recommend it. It was a great read. Also a great read is Jeff Keighley's The Final Hours of Half-Life 2, which is an article, and I'm a little reluctant to call it an article. It's more like a novella. It took me like 2 hours to read, and it really brought me back to a time when the web could like publish something like that, and it could sustain itself, I guess. So it's a great article, and I'm pulling most of my information about the development period of Half-Life 2 from that article. And if you're interested in this at all, and you must be if you're listening to this episode, please go read that article. Clear out 2 hours of your life and just read it. It's fascinating. It's a look into this game's development process that not a lot of people had, and I don't think I've seen this in-depth journalism done that often since then. So, I mean, it's very hard to get that kind of opportunity. I'm not calling anyone out, but man, this is a great article.
Access is a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Valve seems like this Willy Wonka factory, and they're not willing to let a lot of people in to see this, how the sausage is made. The delicious sausage, that is. So now I want to talk about this game. It had a very troubled development history, and it was originally planned to release on September 30th of 2003, and it took an entire year after that for it to finally hit, actually a little bit more than a year. But this had an 84-person team, which was probably big at the time, but now it's not that big for a AAA game. Not anymore, rather, because like what, Ubisoft has like 700 people in their credits now across multiple countries.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
Bethesda has like 100 people on Fallout 4. That's considered small.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the little mom-and-pop developer. But yeah, 84 people, 5 years of development. Development started in 1999, 6 months after Half-Life 1 shipped. And essentially, I think what made this game so good, and by the way, I'm a big fan of this game, as is Kevin. Jeremy seems to take it personally, but I think the reason this game is so good is because of the amount of chances they had. Now I always bring this up, but Resident Evil 4 is another game I think benefited from a kind of second and third chances that a lot of games don't get these days. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to the drawing board, figure this out again. And it feels like with reading about Half-Life 2, a lot of the best ideas came in the final stretch of the game in terms of development. Yeah. So, and basically, like Valve, Gabe Newell and his partner, who eventually left to go like sail the world with his wife, they had all this money from their Microsoft days and from their Half-Life 1 days, and they're like, essentially, like, we have all this money, all this time, and our goal is to be a worthy successor to Half-Life. That was our only goal. And they had some problems with the publisher, and I won't get into that, but they were being sued or something like that by their Vivendi Universal publisher. It's weird to think of Valve no longer – I mean, it's weird to think of Valve not as a publisher these days. You know what I mean? Because they're a huge publisher, and it's also weird to think of Half-Life 1 as a Sierra game. You know, like my favorite Sierra games are King's Quest and Half-Life, you know, my favorite point-click adventure games. So yeah.
Well, I mean, Half-Life 2 was a big part of Valve becoming a publisher, becoming not just a publisher, but becoming a system through which video games are delivered to the world.
Right. Steam debuted in 2002. And if you go back and read articles about it, there was a lot of hand-wringing about the idea of like, what will happen to the box game and all this stuff. But now we're in the post-Steam world and we're all comfortable with buying our AAA releases for $5 6 months later. So I feel like we're okay with Steam now, but there was some hand-wringing. But back to Half-Life 2, this game, their mission statement was to, quote, push the boundaries of interactivity, which I think they did a good job with. And even though the game is 11 years old, I'm still impressed by how just organic playing around in this world is, even though it is somewhat primitive compared to what a modern game can do. It's still very impressive to me today, and I'm sure we'll talk about why soon. And there was always this fear that Gabe Newell talked about the fear of giving players too much control. And that especially figures into the game with the whole physics equation, because physics are a huge part of Half-Life 2. And we'll talk more about that as we get into the game itself. This is just kind of background info stuff for now. But there was another big controversy. This game was like rife with controversy, the publisher suing them, but also someone hacked into Valve, a German hacker, and basically stole the entire source code, as I think gamers were at their angriest about the delays on this game. So this guy was just releasing like assets, and people are being mad like, this is the state of the game that's coming out next year. And they were like totally offended by it. But I think the German forces arrested this hacker because this hilarious like Ocean's 11 style plan where they were going to invite this guy over to Valve to be a security expert. But they were really inviting him to America to arrest him for stealing the game and hacking into their servers and stuff like that. So yeah, that's all of this background info of Half-Life. Am I missing anything? I'm just trying to provide context as to what was happening in the world as this was going on. It was a hugely anticipated game, and I think we all forget about people complaining about how often it was delayed.
Well, I remember when the time was coming and Valve wasn't saying anything. So I think the original release date was like September 2003.
That's right. It was like September 30th or something like that.
And
yeah,
it was
yeah.
just coming and coming. And it was sort of like Alpha Protocol not so long ago where it's just like the release date is coming and nobody's saying anything and nobody's saying anything. And it just came and went.
Yeah.
And I very much remember because I was looking forward to the game. Also worth noting that a lot of the things we thought were going to be there, for example, the big showing they had at E3 when they did show Half-Life 2. A lot of that stuff never made it into the game, like the big tentacle in the water.
That's right,
bit.
Yeah.
So a little background there. I thought, and I believe that they took it out just because they said this isn't fun. Mm. We couldn't make this fun.
Right.
So we just yanked it.
And there was a lot of going back to the drawing board, as I said before. Like they really dialed back on dialogue and like these quote unquote cutscenes, which were not really cutscenes because they're keeping you in the action, but. Like Gabe was looking at this stuff and he's like, this is not fun. Like watching these characters talk is not fun. And there's still some of those moments in Half-Life 2 where they do talk a little too much while confining you to one area. But I think that it could have been much worse. This is a game that's very light on plot for the best, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny you mentioned that release date. Like reading that article, The Final Hours of Half-Life 2, which is really like the final year of Half-Life 2.
How many hours in a year?
I don't know. I'm not a calculator. But they had a launch party planned on Alcatraz for – I think ATI was funding it because they were supposed to do some content for ATI, which I don't think came through. But they still had to have their launch party a year before the game came out. There was a launch party. So I guess they had something to show off there. But the game was not out, but they still had a launch party, which I think is hilarious. So I don't know if
that's really weird.
Were you working at GameSpot at the time they had that
no,
launch party? Okay.
No, I didn't start till 2006.
Got it. I was wondering if you knew anyone who was at that Alcatraz thing. That sounded pretty hilarious to me.
I had just started at 1UP, so I probably had colleagues who went. You know, people from – it was not Games for Windows magazine, Computer Gaming World. I'm sure like Darren Gladstone or Jeff Green or someone went, so it'd be great to talk to them about it.
Yeah, that'll be a follow-up to this. Like Jeff Green, what was the sad Half-Life 2 party like? And he probably won't remember it because it was 11 years ago. So let's get on to the main topic, Half-Life 3. There's a lot of release dates for this game. It was released on November 16th, 2004 for the PC. The Xbox version, that's Xbox Original, not Xbox One. We can't say that anymore. That happened exactly a year later. And then the Orange Box was in 2007. So I think most people didn't get to play this game until 2007. I mean, it sold millions on the PC, but I think it reached maximum relevancy with that Orange Box release because that was like this magical time when Valve was like, here's a bunch of things we made all together. If you didn't have a PC before, now here's your chance to play all these games. So where was everybody when Half-Life 2 came out? Were you excited? Were you ready for this game? Were you suffering through delays? Jeremy, how about you?
I mean, I reviewed it for 1UP. I was interested in it. I wasn't super stoked for it. I had played Half-Life eventually when it came to PlayStation 2 and was looking forward to playing Half-Life 2 in a much better scenario because the Gearbox port of Half-Life Mm-mm. 1 was not great. But yeah, it was kind of weird for me because I had a PC at my desk and never really used it that much because I'm not a PC gaming person. So this was like, a chance for me to actually use this kind of nice rig that they built for me at 1UP. So it was kind of a test run for me. I remember, being kind of curious about it because Steam was a big part of a big component of it.
Yeah, you had to install it. Even if you bought the box copy, you had to install it.
I mentioned that this was, the game was a big deal for Valve as a publisher because Steam existed, but no one really wanted it or cared about it. But they forced it on everyone with this game. They said, hey, millions of people who want to play this game, if you want to play it, you got to put Steam on here. And it was a mess. It was a nightmare. It was a disaster.
There's a reason people did not like Steam at first. And it wouldn't be until like 2005 where they would have third-party games. But I mean, can you describe the problems with it? Was it just like actually downloading the game?
I don't even remember everything. It was basically just like everyone was acquiring this this new service and – you know, this thing that barely anyone had used all of a sudden was getting millions of connections of people who wanted to access the game. You had to authenticate it with Steam in order to play. And it took some people like an entire day to be able to do that. It was kind of a taste of how gaming is these days.
Yeah, I had that problem with Fallout 4, having to download half of the game because it wasn't on the actual disc I was given.
But there were some interesting things that resulted from the advent of Steam. This is the first game I can think of that really started having these additional components added to it post-launch. Half-Life, I don't know if you remember this, but there's a multiplayer component to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not all that great, but it did not ship with that. When it came out day one, it was just a single-player game. And then maybe like a month later, they released the multiplayer element, which I remember mainly being me using the gravity gun to throw toilets at people. That was pretty much Half-Life 2, the multiplayer experience.
And they released Lost Coast, which was like, we upgraded the source engine. Here's what a level looks like in this upgraded
world. Yeah, so it was kind of like this – it's kind of weird to think about now that the entire concept of Half-Life is dead. But it was like this living product that just continued to update and to roll out.
It kept on giving.
Which is something I hadn't really seen. I mean, I guess MMOs did that, but this wasn't an MMO. It was a It was a first-person single-player shooter.
There was even new lighting just released not too long ago in the last few months, I think, a new lighting model for Half-Life 2. So they still keep going.
Yeah, and I remember, like, this is not Half-Life 2 related, but when I finally stopped being reluctant about installing Steam, I was like, what can I play on this? And I found, like, my old Sierra version of Half-Life 1, the CD case, and I was like, I'll put this code in, and, like, boom. It gave me every Half-Life 1 thing, like, every expansion pack, like, all three of them or whatever. I was like, I like Steam, okay? I'm getting free stuff, so that's great. So I was looking into who made this game, and I don't think a lot of these people are still at Valve, but the project lead was someone named David Spayrer. It's a hard name to say, people. David Spayrer, who's still at Valve doing Valve things. But I don't think any real name emerged from this project because, like, we just did an episode about Ocarina of Time. And for that project, it was like a bunch of directors working on their own parts of the game, a very collaborative environment with one guy overseeing everything. I feel like Half-Life 2 is very much the same way. Like, everyone was in charge of their own part of the game, which is why So many chunks of this game feel so different. Like, there's driving, there's gravity puzzles, there's combat. Like, I feel like everybody put their own stamp on their own section, so it's hard to feel like pull out one person's like auteur like personality taking over the whole project.
The only person I can think of, and I think his name is Viktor Antonov. He was the art director. And I think that he's probably most well known because his face was used as the inspiration for Father Grigori.
Oh, you're right.
In Ravenholm.
Yeah.
So that's the only when I think of individual people from Half-Life 2, that's really the only individual I think of.
I always think of Mark Laidlaw.
Yeah,
he is
the writer.
He is the writer, the story guy.
Yeah.
But having played through this again recently, almost to the end, I did not get to the end because it's a very long game. But Mark Laidlaw, he did do the writing, but there's not a lot of writing in this game. Like, I was going back into it. I last played through it in 2007 when Episode 2 came out. And I was expecting a lot more story, but it's so light on story. And I find like the I'm not insulting this game and I like the game, but like what you do in the game is basically just traveling from point A to point B. It's like when you start the game, it's like, okay, we're going to transport you to this lab. Oops, the transporter screwed up. Now you've got to walk there. Oh, now you've walked to this lab and the guy that you wanted to find was kidnapped. Now go to find out where he was kidnapped. Like most of your actions in the game are just going to the next place and finding out you have to go to another place.
Yeah, but the story that he developed was also more than just the plot. It was, you know, the backstory and the history and like there's all this stuff developed that has never been released to the public.
Right.
Apparently, there's a lot of a story bible to Half-Life.
It's funny you mentioned that because my friend Gary Butterfield brought this up on Watch Out for Fireballs, another retro games podcast. But like the Half-Life timeline has like three events in it. And that's basically it. And three events that are like explicit to the audience, like the Resonance Cascade accident, the 7-hour war, and whatever Gordon Freeman does.
Yeah, but there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot more to it that we don't necessarily see right up front. But these are the kinds of things where if you're like me and you've played it over and over and over again.
I'm sure you're picking up on a lot of things that I'm not.
You do pick up on a lot of things, and there are lots of bits and pieces that you start to put together. And there was a time when Half-Life 2 was, you know, still relatively new, and people started putting this together and they'd put it up online. I was like, how on earth did you come to these conclusions? But then as you start playing, you're like, oh, now I totally see this. I start to see the relationship. I start to see where the Combine came from and where the, you know, just things that seem so simple. The Combine weren't in the original Half-Life.
Right.
You know, obviously. But then suddenly they've taken over the world. What is going on here? And I think part of why I love that this particular narrative so much is that it does reward me whenever I play. I get one more piece
right.
that I missed the last time.
And it never like comes out and tells you what's happening, which is something I really like. Like I feel like in Half-Life 2, they're taking what they did in Half-Life 1 and really doubling down on it, as they're doing with a lot of things they did in Half-Life 1. Like the story, and I'll just use a stupid Dark Souls comparison, but it does feel like that because it's a story told through environment and enemy placement, and like not a character saying here's what's happening and like read this lore. It's just like, oh, there is one of those rockets in the ground that dispenses headcrabs. This is going to be a zombie area coming up, or something happened here where there are going to be zombies because, you know, this area was attacked for being an uprising or something like that. Where I don't know, I get a lot of like just atmosphere and story from how enemies are placed and just what's going on in the background and things like that.
There's
and,
something can I elaborate on that? For
oh, sure,
a
go
second?
For it. Yeah.
There's something, and I sort of noted this in my article that I really love, and you don't notice this, of course, when you lots of details in games you don't notice the. It's ways that they draw the eye, for example. But for example, when you see when you see ceiling tentacles, for example, for the first time, there are always little subtle ways where the game is drawing your attention. And that stuff is important because now we're getting used to press Y for the camera to move and look at a thing that you're supposed to look at. Something like Half-Life 2 made today is actually pretty ballsy because they actually have to use really subtle techniques in lighting and in level design to draw your attention to things that are really important. Mm-hmm. Now it's just like, hey, look over here. We're going to yank control away from
right.
you. And I think, you know, when people talk about cinematic games, we often think of games that yank control away from you. But I actually think of something like Half-Life 2 is more cinematic because it's actually using – you know, elements that you see in film to draw your eye without actually having to force the camera around to make you look at something.
I think it's using the language of games to tell a story rather than borrowing from like, we're going to show you this. You have to figure it out. And I feel like you're right. They do lead your eye in a way. Like, I do feel like I'm viewing this from a 2015 perspective. I do think like games like Left 4 Dead, which is like spun out of the Half-Life kind of mentality, they did a much better job of leading you because it's like, oh, go to this door with a big light over it. But it was a little less subtle. But I feel like I was still getting lost a tiny bit in Half-Life 2, but I still liked how much trust they put in me. Like, we're going to let you figure out how to get to this point. And it was funny, like when I was playing this 11 years ago, I had a much different idea of what a game should be. And I was like, I'm in this open city. Why can't I backtrack? Why can't I like go back to where I was? It's like I didn't understand. I was subtly being led down a pretty linear path, but still it was up to me to, you know, go down that path.
Yeah, that was always it's still my big complaint about Half-Life 2 is that it's very much the epitome of roller coaster video game design. Like, you're kind of on a rail and you're going forward and you're supposed to kind of look around and observe and say, oh, look at all these great things. But they're all kind of out of reach. It's like an amusement park ride.
See, to me – oh, I'm sorry.
I'm – you know, that's a valid design approach. Yeah. It's just not one that I necessarily enjoy. I like having a little more freedom to kind of do my own thing.
I think that this kind of game – okay, so I guess to get it out of the way, like I really feel like Half-Life 2 is like sort of the foundation for the modern video game experience. Like it is so influential. But I feel like what it did has really been perverted. Like, we still have those roller coaster games, but as you said, Kevin, it's like hit Y to look at the thing. And like, we can say it now, like Half-Life 2 did not create that intro, the non-interactive kind of like literally a tram ride intro, but Half-Life 1 did. But that is basically the de facto video game intro, isn't it, at this point? Like, we're going to give you a scenario in which you can soak up the atmosphere. You can't kill anything. Nothing can kill you, but you can learn about the world before we give you your abilities. That's like Valve created that pretty much.
Yeah, but you know, then, I mean, you're right. Then it was perverted. If you look at something like what then, say, Modern Warfare – brought to it. It just squeezed it in even more.
Yeah, yeah.
And even games like Fear and so on and so forth. These ended up being corridor shooters in which you essentially just went from point A to point B. But what's really interesting to me is it seems like modern shooters, you have only really the two types now. You have with very few in-betweens, you have sort of the Modern Warfare style where you really are just going from point A to point B. You shoot, there's cutscene, you go from point A to point B and so on and so forth. Or you have big open world, hey, I'm Far Cry,
right,
you know, type of thing. But there aren't very many games that follow that model of we're linear, but we have we fool you with large spaces that you're moving through or complex spaces that you're moving through to give the impression of something a little bit bigger, to give the impression of a larger world. And there are games now that still do that. Greg Kasavin actually pointed out to me that Duke Nukem Forever was very much in the Half-Life 2 mold from that perspective.
I guess it was created – development started before Half-Life 2, so yeah. it was of that era.
But
Half-Life 2 was like Duke Nukem Forever.
Oh, no.
Oh, God. But I mean something like maybe Crysis 2 and Crysis 3 are games that I think are sort of from that mold. They're not really open world, but they're not really, you know, straight down the corridor in very tight spaces.
Wolfenstein, yeah. The new Wolfenstein games do that
that's
a lot.
That's a
good point. And Halo, too, actually.
Halo.
I think people forget about Halo, but.
Yeah, no, Halo's very much the same way. I think part of the reason I left out Halo is just that the feel is so different and the tone is so different that it really didn't cross my mind.
I did go into this game with that mentality. Like, I don't like the modern AAA lead you by the hand experience. I'm afraid Half-Life is going to be that, but from a different era. But it's much more generous. It's much less leading. And I feel like it is much less patronizing because, like, they could have given you Alex barking in your ear for the entire game. And another developer might have done that just to, like, I don't want you, this player, getting lost and give my game a bad review. And even when they give you radio contact with Alex, she just says a few things and that's it. Like, I was like, is this the point when the game starts talking to me? Oh, it's not. Like, they leave you alone, which is like, games never really leave you alone for that long. And I was just like, this feels like it was strange, even for 2004, when things were just moving in a much different direction than Half-Life was.
Even when you think of the soundtrack, you think of game soundtracks nowadays very bombastic. It's you know, in like a lot of bad films, for example, a lot of video games, you know, we're going to force you to think or feel a certain way with our soundtrack now. Half-Life 2's soundtrack is very, very sparse. There's not a whole lot going on in music. You have long periods where you're just hearing ambient audio.
Right.
You don't actually get soundtrack at all. And I think that's really interesting.
And it really only underscores battles. It doesn't underscore emotional scenes or anything like that.
Right.
At least it could in after the point where I stopped playing, but it really just uses that music to underscore battles and punctuate battles and stuff like that.
Again, a game that trusts you.
Yeah. And going back to this game, I know they've updated lighting and stuff, but I still think it looks really good. I mean, the skybox is still kind of primitive, but I feel like if this game were made today, there'd just be a lot more crap floating in the air, you know, just like a lot more particles floating in the air for no reason. That is a sign of a current gen game, isn't it? Just like dust moats. Everything's very dusty.
That and HDR lighting and like kind of desaturated color.
Yeah. Like even if – I mean the lighting is still kind of flat, but this game still holds up I think because of artistic choices. Like it's not quite photorealistic, but it's also not quite that stylized. But just the color choices are just so evocative of what they're trying to communicate. And this was the Havok engine's debut, I believe. The first Half-Life was run off of a modified version of the Quake engine. Is that correct?
Yep.
And it doesn't hold up as good, but this game still looks really great, I think.
So Source, just to make sure we throw that out there, it's the Source engine.
Right.
Is the visual engine.
Right. Havok is physics.
Havok was physics.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. This is, Source is proprietary. Valve created it, correct? And Havok was something they licensed, but they heavily modified it to do all the magic things they wanted to do. And this game is like – it's a half combat, half like physics puzzle game, which just like – I think the physics puzzle thing kind of turned into Portal after Half-Life 2 came out because it's a big family full of games. But just going back into this, this was such a novel thing in games at the time. We take it so for granted now because everything is a ragdoll. Everything is sliding around like as it would in real life. But I don't think before Half-Life 2, like items in the world did not have the presence they did in Half-Life 2. Like the first thing they make you do in this game is stack crates to get out of a window. It's just telling you from that first step.
Actually, before that, isn't there a guy who's like, pick up the can?
Oh, yeah, the soda can is like that moment where you're like, oh, geez, I can pick up the soda can and move it around and throw it around. And what happens if I throw it at the Combine soldier? And I think you should go and do that right now to discover exactly what happens.
Now you get an achievement for that, right?
I think you do get an achievement now. But it's also important to note that you can die in Half-Life 2 before you ever get a gun.
Yeah. But the thing about the crates, it's just like that. I mean, like, of course, I know now what Half-Life 2 is and what it's doing. But at the time, it's just like, no, these are items in the world. They have their own reality to them. And you can use them as you would in the real world. So stack these. I mean, there was like boxes in Zelda, but you couldn't really move them around anywhere you wanted them to. You could throw them and they'd explode, and you can push around like giant blocks and stuff. But here, it's an item with a certain weight, a certain physicality, and you can conceivably put it wherever you want to, as long as you don't just like destroy it. So there are so many things that are just physics puzzles in this game. And what I like about this physics engine, as much as gimmicky as it could be, it lends a certain reality to the nature of these puzzles. And one of the ones I point out that really just – it still wowed me today is I was playing through the Nova Prospect, the prison level, and there's this one area that is blocked by a giant industrial fan. And I'm like, where's the switch for this thing? Like, how do I get through it? And there's a bunch of items in the room you can try to use to stop the fan. And the one thing that works is like the shovel handle. But it's just like you're using things you would do in real life. Your own logic fits in with the game's logic because it's trying to approximate reality in some way. And I realize the boxes are all – everything is like a water balloon in this world essentially. That's like – it has like the heft of a water balloon. But still, it's fun to play around with these physics puzzles. Do you guys have any like highlights as far as like – we'll get to the gravity gun in a bit here. But just like in terms of pure physics, like what did you think of Half-Life 2 at the time? What was it as a – like I just remember being astounded like, wow, games are going to just approximate reality in this strange way now, and I love it.
There are three things that jump to mind. One is the way the physics were used during combat. In the first combat scenarios where suddenly you have all these explodey barrels and things that fall apart when they explode, and hey, a Combine soldier is falling off that little bridge, and how amazing is that? Now when I go back and play, that stuff doesn't hold up at all because we're so used to seeing explodey barrels and things fall exactly where you're meant to make that happen. A little of the magic is lost, but my favorite physics puzzle – so I have two feelings about the physics puzzle. My favorite is the one in underwater where you have to like get the crate up to the surface.
That's
so
right,
you have to go under and sort of push stuff, you know, underneath stuff and move stuff from where it is. And I'm doing a terrible job of explaining how that puzzle works. But that's probably my favorite puzzle. It really helps also break up the water hazard level.
So
the whole thing is great.
You're really just using buoyancy to make a platform.
Yeah,
like the natural property of buoyancy.
I love that. But I will be the one who will defend water hazard to the death. So maybe we'll get to that. Maybe we won't. But on the other hand, there is this physics puzzle that I absolutely hate every time I play it, and it's one of the very first things you do is you have to stack cement blocks onto this seesaw type thing, onto this plank,
yes,
so that you can then run and jump and get out of there. You have to basically, you know, get that, you know, tilt it and then run, get the momentum and jump. I hate that freaking puzzle so much.
Is that because the cinder blocks just slide off the seesaw, or
that's part of it? Part of it is just simply boring, and the other part is that you actually have to be pretty precise with that jump. And if you mess up just something really small, it's like, oh God, I have to do this again. Oh, and look, the thing I didn't make the jump, and now look, that cinder block slid off somehow. So now I have to. So it's probably my very least favorite thing in all of Half-Life 2, which
jumping
is
in any game where you can't see your feet is a little odd. There's a lot of platforming in Half-Life 2 that I think works because you have a lot of tools, but sometimes it just feels a little off and you're not like, am I on this thing? Am I going to slide off it? Yep. There's one puzzle that I really love, but I think it's hard, where I feel like it's the ultimate test of learning how to use physics, in which you have to cross this giant traverse of like wasteland that you can't get into.
I hate that so much.
It was hard, but I liked how much it made me work. Like, so you have three crates and you just like start, you put them in front of you, walk on them, like pull the ones from behind you in front of you, and you keep building like this ever expanding, well, not really. It's just like you keep moving a small chunk of bridge through this wasteland as zombies are popping up trying to destroy your boxes. Like I don't know. It took me so many tries to do that, but when I finally did it, I was like, yes. And I used what I learned from the game to, you know that was possible.
So my feeling on physics is, I mean, it was an impressive game, no question. But I really feel like a lot of the physics in Half-Life 2 got in the way of the gameplay, or it just kind of slowed down the experience. There were so many instances in the game where I feel like everything just ground to a halt while you had to pick up things and move them around and put them just so – like I think maybe we're talking about a different part, but the part in the wasteland where there's ant lions and you can't walk on the soil.
Yeah, that's exactly so what I was referring to.
So you're taking those stupid like sheets of metal and stuff and putting them down and making a pathway. It's so boring.
I don't like that part.
It's not challenging. It's just dull. And the water hazard puzzle where you're trying to like create a ramp for the boat, like that's really boring. It just feels like anytime the action stops and you have to put stuff together, it just doesn't work as well as they wanted it to. And to me, it also really like that's kind of what broke my immersion in the game, because here's all this realistic quote unquote physics and look at all the things you can do in the real world. But I also have a rocket launcher and maybe I could just blast through this chain link fence to move to the other side. Oh, no, that's a really tough chain link fence. I guess I'll have to, you know, use the artificial
physics. That's combined technology.
Elements. Yeah. So it's really cool. It was a really great technological advance, but I feel like it's not as smoothly integrated as they would have liked. And those parts kind of undermine the game for me, to be honest.
I don't know. Like, I feel like there's a point sometimes when Half-Life 2 drags a little, where you're like, I get it. I get how to do this. Can I please do something else? Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't like it if it was all just combat. I feel like the game is paced very well outside of those times where it drags on. I know I'm contradicting myself, but I feel like in terms of pacing, it knows how to move you between different activities. Because like they don't want you to – I mean, I think Valve are the masters of this. Like, we understand like combat fatigue. Like, after a big combat set piece, you're going to be like exploring for a bit. Or after a bit of exploring, they're going to run into combat. And sometimes it surprises you, like, oh, I'm doing this now? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there are parts where I think the pacing is great. I wouldn't want the game to be just shooting. And I love the part where there's kind of like this huge metal scaffolding bridge across a big chasm, and you're out there kind of, you know, traversing that. And it's right around the time you first get the cross bolt. And I love that part.
That part is so good.
Because it's really so challenging. Like, you're really like, oh my God, I'm way up in the air. There's nothing underneath me. Enemies show up occasionally. There's even like a head crab at one point, like one of the poison head crabs, and it freaks you out. It's a really great sequence. And because you have that cross bolt, you suddenly have this incredibly precise, powerful tool
that
when
that
you
thing.
Do get into yeah. trouble, like if you pick your shots really carefully, you can get yourself out of trouble pretty easily. But, you know, it requires careful play. It requires some skill. Like, stuff like that is just, you know, it's why when I look back at Half-Life 2, I'm like, oh, that's such a great game. Then there's all those other parts where when I actually go back to replay the game, I'm like, oh, God, why am I replaying this game?
I will say in terms of combat, the game does not offer the things we've come to expect from a first-person shooter. Like, I believe only the crossbow has like iron sights, quote-unquote. You can zoom in using the Z button or the Z key, but you can't actually fire from being zoomed in. So I think like – and also I find like a lot of the challenge is switching to the right weapon at the right time. Like, that's baked into the game because there's no like melee attack button, you know, like you have in every FPS. So like if I need to take out my crowbar to attack a headcrab and I don't want to waste ammo, I have to scroll to it, and I always scroll past it and I have to go back to it. So I feel like stuff like that and, you know, the whole save scumming thing, it's like baked into this game as like just like a feature. Like, this is how you're going to play this game. Like, are these weird systems that were common at the time are now part of the challenge.
Yeah, it seems kind of quaint right now, right? Just like the idea of non-regenerating health seems very quaint. But one of the reasons I love Half-Life 2, and of course the original Half-Life for that matter, is that there's actually a narrative reason for why you can actually take that much damage and how, you know, how it works. Of course, it doesn't necessarily make sense that there are little health power-ups everywhere.
Yeah, and
like
they have suit charging stations where there shouldn't be suit charging stations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think overall what I really like about that is that it's not – it's, you know, at least they gave some narrative purpose to that stuff. You know, why is this man who is not – you know, a combat soldier still able to take so much damage. Hey, there actually is a reason.
Right.
So
he has a super suit.
Yeah.
So what I found pretty interesting about this game, having played but not finished Half-Life 1, this is a game that's much much more serious. There's still silly parts to it, but I find that Half-Life 1 was a little silly in the like the fun 90s way, where some of your enemies were like female assassin ninjas and things like that, and there was a real like kind of tude the game had. Half-Life 2 is more of like a dystopian and bleak game, and one of the things they did in this game that I found was very interesting that makes no sense at all, like in Half-Life 1, there were very few NPCs and they were all like kind of clones of each other with the same voice. And all of those were just like kind of like put in a machine and squished into one character. So all the Barneys you met were now just Barney, and all the Dr. Kleiners you met were just one guy now. And like how did you that was just like strange to me. Like how did you think about that, Kevin? Like when these characters somehow survived and now we're just one guy.
Well, it's I mean, that's progress, right?
I guess so.
Sense, you know, if you're going to, you know, you're now going to tell a story about people. I mean, really, Half-Life 1 is the story about Gordon Freeman and, you know, the story of, you know, I guess a little bit about the story of Zen and the Vortigaunts and the story of the G-Man. But really, that's about it. None of those other people really matter.
They're just fodder for the most part.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, finally, you get to Half-Life 2. Now you're actually making these people something. You're making them people. And I think that's, you know, that's an important part of that. I mean, there really is that moment too. It does feel very almost humorous at the time. It's sort of jaunty when Barney reveals himself for the first
time. Right, yeah.
there's that, hey, remember me? And it's sort of cute in that
it's
way.
Like, I saw you die several times.
Yeah. and the game actually has little nods, to the earlier game to kind of, you know, things that we might see as hand wavy, but to me, they're just little Easter eggs saying, hey, remember the first game? We remember that this thing was silly. Hmm. We're actually gonna note that. So, for example, there's the very end of Half-Life 2. So, spoilers, obviously, but at the very end of Half-Life 2, G-Man says to you, I'm not gonna give you the illusion of choice. I'm going to make a decision for you. Bye-bye, go back into stasis. And that whole thing is a reference to the end of Half-Life 1 where you make a choice, but then if you choose to basically die at the end of Half-Life 1, that doesn't matter because they go with the other ending for Half-Life 2.
Right.
So there's an illusion, you know, the choice doesn't matter because Half-Life 2's, you know, the story is still going to do what it does. So stuff like that is actually really meaningful to me because it feels like, hey, here's a little nudge to this thing we did before where we're going to acknowledge that some of this was silly.
And I remember Gabe in the many interviews I read with him about Half-Life 2, he regrets in Half-Life 1 not spending enough time on the NPCs. They were just kind of like something that was interesting but not they were more interested in making levels and combat scenarios and stuff like that. But the fact in Half-Life 1 that there were characters that weren't there for you to kill was a really interesting thing. Characters you could talk to, not in an RPG, not in like – it was an FPS, but there are these things that you weren't supposed to kill in the beginning, which I thought was really interesting. But for Half-Life 2, they hired like a Disney animator to essentially build the face technology to make these characters more appealing, to make them more interesting, to make them more compelling as people, which I thought like they really wanted this really, really tiny cast of characters to be personable and to be interesting even though some of them are jerks.
It's interesting too. Even when you play now, I mean, it looks really good.
Yeah, we come to expect a higher standard, but I'm not like put off like, oh, this is Uncanny Valley or whatever. Like, it still works.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I'd rather play Half-Life 2. Those people feel more real. Their faces seem more natural and present than something like L.A. Noire, which is praised as. You know, but with L.A. Noire, I look at that and it's like, oh, your face looks like a real person. The rest of you looks like a robot.
It's like an FMV mask projected on a mannequin.
Yeah, I don't, there was like some weird magic to Half-Life 2 and Silent Hill 3 that no other games of those era had.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I wonder did they kidnap some Disney guy for Silent Hill 3? Because it was like a year before Half-Life 2, so early aughts, something was happening there.
But only in a few limited situations.
Yes. Yeah. So we will take a break now and we'll come back with more Half-Life 2 talk. So we're back from break, and I did want to talk a little bit about the narrative in Half-Life 2. And we talked a little bit about it previously where there's not a whole lot of narrative there, but I do feel like this game does follow a pretty good philosophy of not interrupting gameplay too often. I do feel like they have to lock you down in order to deliver certain bits of exposition. It only happens like two or three times though, but it seems like around this time, I think developers were just beginning to realize like story and play can be like together as one, I think. Did you guys notice this around this time? Like, I mean, it took some developers much longer to figure it out where like, no, story like just puts play to an end and then you look at the story and then you go back to the game. But I feel like Half-Life 2 was like, no, you can have both, and if we lock you in a room, you can at least break stuff in the room, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because we say that there's not a lot of narrative in Half-Life 2, but I'm actually sort of going to beg to differ with that. I don't think there's a lot of talking.
That's true.
In Half-Life 2.
Yeah.
But I think there's actually a ton of narrative, and I'll give you one quick example, and then throw it over to Jeremy, who needs to talk.
Yes,
more.
Please.
To give you an example, and of course Half-Life 2 is a game made in a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular political climate. And there's a lot – and this comes through in particular once you get out of City 17 and once you get into the water hazard level and, you're on your way to Nova Prospect and so on and so forth. You start sensing sort of the locale, for example. And I don't think that there's a specific locale that's ever been identified, but this is clearly Eastern Europe. This is clearly
– right.
I would say Ukraine. And once you start realizing some of the ties to real world Earth, and of course this is a game that actually takes place on Earth, you start to notice some of the thematic relevance. And so, for example, you're going through and you start seeing the tenement buildings as you go through the waterway, and you start seeing and go through factories and warehouses and things like that. And it's distinctly Eastern European, and more so, it's distinctly calling to Chernobyl.
Mm,
and
that's true.
Stalker would ultimately go there, all in. But at this point, you throw in something like you've got clearly you're in Eastern Europe. Clearly, they're trying to evoke Chernobyl. And go beyond that, and you start looking at Dr. Breen. For example, you go into places, and Dr. Breen's message has changed, and he's talking in a certain way about magical thinking, and he's cautioning against Gordon as like the one free man and as the savior, and so on. All of this stuff is very Trotsky-esque, very Lenin-esque. A lot of this stuff is very similar to what's referred to as like the new Soviet man.
Hmm.
And so all of this stuff is being brought up, and especially if you played it in the time when it was released, whether or not you know it, it's evoking a certain kind of idea. It's evoking a certain kind of place. It's evoking the way the Russian government responded to the Chernobyl incident, which is we're not going to tell anybody for 3 days until people around the world start noticing that there was all this radiation. Where did it come from? And you hear that in Dr. Breen's words. And so that's one kind of small example of what I think is total narrative, but it's not dialogue. It's not a cutscene. It's something that's just happening around you. And whether or not you know it, you're absorbing this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's becoming the creation of the world. And then so you talked about Dark Souls earlier.
I never stopped talking
briefly
about Dark Souls.
Can I be on a Dark Souls cast when 10 years have passed?
In 2021, it'll happen.
But, it's sort of Dark Souls-esque in that way where it's like the information is there if you go look at it, but you have to learn a new kind of narrative language. You have to learn that it's not being fed to you anymore. There's a reason these things are there, and you actually can pay attention to them and get something out of it. And that's – again, that's really rare. It's one of the reasons I love Dark Souls, but also one of the reasons I love Half-Life 2. These are things that you can get out of it. It's just not being spoon-fed to you. And it's also part of the pacing and a lot of other things about, what is happening to me. It's very important that, you have to think, why do these people even look to me as their savior? I'm just some dude.
Yeah.
That's – maybe we can get into that more, but
sure.
An example of why I love the narrative, even though by most standards there's not a lot of it, I would actually say it's loaded with it.
Hmm.
It's just not narrative we're used to.
I can see that. Jeremy, what do you think about it?
Are we allowed to talk about the episodes here?
I want to save that for a latter part, but is this something related to just the in general how Half-Life 2 tells a story?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
So I really think the storytelling in Half-Life 2 is excellent. Mm. You know, as much as I didn't like the kind of, like I said, the roller coaster, the amusement park ride sensation of always being kind of like trapped in this this rail space, I think that the way it unfolds its story for players is really, really subtle and thoughtful, and there's so much to chew on as you explore the game. I really like it. I feel like in the episodes, the game's story really starts to fall apart because it tries to build more with the limitations of the original Half-Life, of Gordon as this silent hero who never talks. And they even talk about like the fact that, oh, you don't say much, do you?
Yeah, they do hang a lantern on that a few times.
Yeah, like they try to turn that into something deeper. And the relationship with Alex really bothers me in the episodes because, you know, if you look at the game in the game story, you have Gordon basically doing the Black Mesa incident, being frozen for 17 years or whatever, coming out of suspended animation, fighting for like 12 hours, and then getting to the episodes. And in that 12-hour space, like somehow Alex, who has never actually been spoken to by Gordon, has fallen deeply in love with him.
Fallen in love with an arm attached to a crowbar.
Yeah. And like I get what they're trying to do, but it doesn't work because there is a difference between the player experience and the actual in-game story. The player experience is that, yes, you've had this adventure with Alex many times. You've developed kind of like a fondness for this virtual character. The episodes came out like 3-4 years after the original Half-Life 2. So you had all this time to chew on it and, you know, just kind of mull over the thoughts, replay the game and so forth. So yeah, like the attachment works there. But within the confines of the story, it falls flat. Like the Gordon as the silent hero stops working when they really start to build personal relationships.
Yeah, I think when they lean on traditional storytelling in those episodes, they really reveal the weaknesses. And I think the strength of Half-Life 2 is that Gordon never really has to talk to people for too long or interact with them like a lot. Like most of this game, like I said before, is the journey to different destinations that you eventually leave because you're not supposed to be there yet, or the thing that you need is now in a different place.
Yeah, it's cool that Gordon helps out Alex a lot and, you know, saves her bacon and kills stuff for her. But it just doesn't work. And the relationship with what's the doctor? What's
Eli?
Her father's name? Eli. Yes.
Yeah. R.I.P. Wait, no, he's still alive. Never mind.
No,
the guy who played Breen is dead. Robert Guillaume.
Oh, the actor.
What? How
Robert
do you say
Guillaume?
His Guillaume.
Yeah, that's Eli Vance.
He's alive. Vance. The guy who played Dr. Breen passed away.
Okay.
Yeah.
Robert Guillaume passed away for some reason. I wonder why I thought that.
He's in his 80s. I Googled it before we came on here.
Well,
yeah.
Thank God somebody knows.
Benson is still alive.
Great. yeah, so like that, to me, that just doesn't work. And I'm curious to see if they ever do a Half-Life 3, how will they change it to make it work better? Because the direction that the episodes took the story, like the narrative became a lot more complex with the Vortigaunts and everything, and the supposedly blossoming relationship between Alex and a gun.
Like it seemed like
it doesn't work. And to me that makes the episodes a lot harder to play because the story is such a big part of Half-Life.
It seemed like they were giving people what they wanted, but to the game's detriment, because it's like people playing Half-Life 2, the story was delivered in such a way that it provided all these opportunities for like mystery, like, ooh, what's happening here? What are these people doing? Or like, what's happening on this side of the globe? And Half-Life 2 tries to answer those in a much more traditional way. And I think that giving people what they wanted ultimately resulted in a less believable story because you are just an arm with a crowbar attached to it. Like your only verb is kill. And that doesn't make for a compelling character.
Lift, throw.
I mean, but you're using those things to kill usually or drive.
Yeah.
There are a few verbs, but they're all pretty lethal.
I wouldn't be surprised if these kind of issues that we're talking about are why we haven't seen a Half-Life 3. I think, you know, there is this fundamental question of how do we advance the game and still be faithful to the spirit of Half-Life? And maybe there's no way to reconcile what the series has been and what it needs to be to feel contemporary and to feel progressive.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to also – like when Kevin was bringing up Russia, like going back into this game and thinking about we're still talking about narrative, by the way, but just thinking about when this game was made and in the political situation, I was thinking of like a post-9/11 like lead up to the Iraq War game where these euphemisms by Dr. Breen feel very much like what we were told for the Patriot Act. Like, this is for your own good. These are things we're going to be taking away from you, but it's for your own good. So just listen to us and we're going to protect you. So I feel like there was a lot of like that kind of post-9/11 paranoia in Half-Life 2 that I still think it's resonant today, but I feel like even at the time it was more like more immediate response. And they weren't like making like, oh, this is the Bush figure, or this is the Cheney figure. But it was hard to escape that level of like, oh, the government is doing things we don't want them to do for our own good. But is it really for our own good? Like, it was like, I mean, I don't want to be reaching. We were not working with an alien like force, but you know.
Yeah, but there is that aspect. You know, certainly. I mean, because the whole idea is that Breen literally thinks that he's doing what's best for humanity.
Right. Yeah, he's somewhat sympathetic.
Yeah, and so I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you could, but the great thing is about, not the great thing, but you know, certainly that kind of political idea crosses generations. So it's always going to come up, you know, how much do we want to give the government, how much faith do we put in the government to protect us versus, you know, how many freedoms do we need to retain for ourselves? That's, I mean, that's a perpetual kind of theme. And I don't know. It was really the locale that really pushes me towards the idea of you know, Soviet Russia.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, visually, of course.
Yeah.
And this game, I don't think we mentioned them much, but this game contains two different vehicles, the Mud Skipper and what is the name of the Dune Buggy? I assume you would know, Kevin.
Dune Buggy?
Let's call it the Awestriker.
There is like a Dune
Buggy. I call it Dune Buggy. I think that's what I call it,
Speed
actually.
Buggy.
I don't remember exactly what it's called. I mean, do they even name it? Do they name either of the vehicles?
It's just
the thing.
They named the boat because I had captions on because I was listening to stuff while I was playing it, and it was like Mud Skipper idling, like a sound effect.
Oh, I didn't even know that had a name.
Yeah, it could be a Ren and Stimpy reference. Who knows?
Damn.
But it sounds like it. But yeah, I mean these are pretty interesting, and that's something I was not expecting when I played this game is vehicle sections, and surprisingly they don't last as long as I thought they would last. I know, Jeremy, do you want to talk about your problem, or did you talk about your problem with the whole boat area?
Yeah, it was just the physics element.
Yeah, okay.
I don't mind the boat driving section. I think that's fine.
Yeah, I find that
it's kind of a back and forth. It's not as seamless as something like Halo.
Right,
where,
of course not.
Like you can, or you know, Tribes if you want to go older than that, where you just like vehicles are there and they're a tool for you. They're very much designed around like you need to get into the vehicle at this point to go to this place and accomplish this thing. But it works. It's fine.
Yeah. And I think this game, like, it does a very good job of breaking up your activities. But when you're driving, you're not just driving for 30 minutes. You're like, oh, what's that house over there? You don't have to go into it. But there's always, like, a fun, like, zombie to fight or, like, items to find. So there's always, like, things along the way from, like, point A to point B when you're driving a vehicle. Kevin, did you enjoy the vehicle segments of this game?
I do. And one of the reasons I love the water hazard level and think it's important.
Oh, that's right. You wanted to this is the hill you're going to die on.
Yeah, I will die on this hill. And because a lot of people, you know, rag on water hazard. And I understand why. But I think it's important that it exists, not only that it just generally exists, but that it exists where it does in the game. Because for a vehicle section, it certainly does seem to come early, right? We wouldn't expect that.
It's very
certainly
early,
in modern
yeah.
games. We wouldn't expect, you know, you're still getting your feet wet with, no pun intended, I swear, with guns. And now suddenly before I even really get a chance to do a lot of stuff with guns, I'm going to do this now. But I think it's really important thematically because I think we're still at the stage – The whole Gordon arc and the whole Chosen One kind of arc here is it, in this stage, you're on the run. And that's one of the things I love mm-hmm. most about Half-Life 2 is that you're not the aggressor. You are at this – certainly at this stage, you are on the run. You don't know what's happening. All you need to know is you have to get the hell out of there. And I think it's really important at this stage in both the narrative and the gameplay arc that we need Gordon to move and we need Gordon to move fast.
Yeah.
And you need for players to be kind of off balance a little bit
yeah.
to replicate the fact that, you know, Gordon narratively has been in quick freeze for the past however many years and all of a sudden is thrust into the situation, handed a crowbar and said, save the world. Yep. Like, you know, it's supposed to be confusing for him. And I think, yeah, when you bring this up, I think the vehicle section's placement does kind of keep players off balance. Like, oh, I finally got, you know, my guns and now I can't use them. I have to, you know, drive around on the boat.
And I think that even ties in with the boss fight sort of at the end of this. So you end up, you know, going after the helicopter thing, whose name I completely forgot. It does actually have a title.
I think it's just called Gunship.
But yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's a gunship.
Yeah.
But that's a
complicated English word. I fought a lot of them, so I remembered.
But I think it's important. Okay, so we want to – so they're saying, okay, we want to have a boss fight. We want to have some kind of culmination here. It's not going to make sense for Gordon on foot to have some kind of boss fight at this stage because he's just too weak. It's just too early in that narrative. And I think it makes sense that he needs some kind of tool to be powerful on his behalf at this stage. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's also an interesting play off of the helicopter, the Apache or whatever, in the original Half-Life, where that thing harried you for so long.
Yes.
And it was just like this constant looming threat. And there was that, you know, kind of release where you finally get the rocket launcher and blow it out of the sky. But here it's a much shorter period of time. Like the gunship appears and it's not there for very long before you take it out. It kind of says like, hey, this is a different experience. Like the stakes are different. It's a bigger, more dangerous world.
But there
and
has...
you have to deal with the big threats right away.
Right. And there has been some growth. I mean, obviously, Gordon's did actually experience the events of Half-Life 1, so he's not going to be completely, you know, powerless.
Right. He knows how to kill.
Yeah.
Like, what you guys are saying is underlining something I wrote in my notes in which this game does a really good job of disempowering you and then giving you that same situation with a much greater arsenal or a much greater ability. Like, that miserable antlion section that I don't like either, Jeremy. I don't think it's that great. It's kind of frustrating. But as soon as that's over, you gain the power to control ants for, like, the next 3 hours of the game. Like, they are your, like, pets that kill everything.
Those are the best.
Yeah, like, I was still amazed by how strong they are. They just destroy everything in their path. And, like, so in another thing that they do in the game is like your first like 20 minutes maybe or maybe 10 minutes you're just running through apartment buildings with no weapon, running from the combine through City 17, and by the time you get back to City 17 you have all of your weapons and squad members, so it's like you're back where you were but now you can kill everything and kick ass. So it's like they like to take away your power or like put you into a situation where you have no power and then give you power. Like even the mud skipper, they eventually put guns on it. You have no guns at first but then they put guns on it and you can shoot things with it. So it's really cool. It makes you feel good. And we also have the gravity gun. And I said in my notes, how damn great is this thing 12 years later, 11 years later? I still love shooting toilets, as you said, Jeremy, throwing them across the room. But it's still a really fun thing to play with. I feel like they made using this thing so fun. I wish it had more lethal capacity. I just wish I could like just pick up guys. But you can eventually. And that's what I think is the greatest moment of Half-Life, where most games make their final stretch like the most difficult, the most annoying thing in the world. Half-Life's ending is kind of like a victory lap. You have the most powerful weapon in the game. You can now suck guys from across the room and shoot them into the stratosphere. That is like – and I mean I am kind of – I mean this is something that Sean Elliott pointed out on an ancient episode of Games for Windows Radio. But it's something that I've been thinking about for a while. Like games that end like this, games that just are like this ending is so perfect. How did you guys feel about this end of Half-Life 2 where it's like here's the ultimate weapon. Just have fun with it because this game is almost over.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
And how rare is it nowadays, certainly in a shooter, to still be unlocking things that far in, that many hours in, and you're still giving me new tools?
Yeah.
And it's sort of inevitable, right? I mean, how many times did you think when you were picking something up and throwing it, God, if only I could just pick up the person and just fling them myself, how great would that be? I mean, it's sort of inevitable that they get there and ballsy that they wait as long as they do to
it is
do it.
Like the last 5% of the game, I would say, yeah, maybe yeah. Even less than that.
And getting to that point is challenging. The final shootouts and everything, they're rough. And to me, those are kind of the final boss in the game. And the upgraded gravity gun, the zero whatever this called gun, it kind of feels like the hyper beam in Super Metroid. Like the game's actually over. And now this is kind of just like the, you know, the denouement. And nothing can stop you at this point. Just go and see how the tale concludes. Like,
yeah.
What's the finale?
I feel like too many games end with frustration and you're only beating them out of the – just like the sunk cost fallacy.
Oh, God,
like,
yes.
I have to finish this game. Jeremy's rubbing his eyes. Can you think of anything in recent memory, Jeremy?
Tomb Raider, Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Okay,
Jesus,
yeah.
The final section of that game. I just wanted to like reach into the screen and throttle someone.
See, Bioshock Infinite.
If Kinect was still – oh, my God. That's – you're totally right.
It's
Please talk
like,
about that, Kevin, because I played it too.
Oh, well, as far as Bioshock Infinite, it really just comes down to, okay, you've given me this game that's relatively easy from beginning to end, and now suddenly you want me to do what?
Yeah.
And how? And how many times? It's funny, like, it took me, like, I don't know, 4 tries to beat the first time I played, obviously. And then I talked to a coworker, and it's like, why did you have so much trouble? I did it the first time. And I was like, really?
For everyone,
songbird.
This is like we're bringing back some bad memories. Everyone's rubbing their faces and like crying. But like no, Bioshock Infinite. I had the same problem, Kevin. Where like also I feel like a lazy decision is like the final boss is a room full of guys. Have fun. But I had to bump the difficulty down to easy. Just oh yeah, Killzone. I had to bump the difficulty down to easy just to beat that boss fight.
All Killzone.
But yeah, but I mean, we'll wait for a Bioshock Infinite podcast in 2023. We'll talk all about it. But yeah, like I find that is a mistake so many games make, but Half-Life avoids that and they make you feel good and they don't patronize you because you worked hard to get to this point, so you might as well have fun. Like they don't want to leave you with bad memories, you know, they want to leave you feeling good, and I feel like this is a great way to end the game. So some final thoughts here. I did want to talk about the influence of Half-Life 2 and we did talk a little bit about how it created a structure that has since been a little perverted, maybe a lot perverted depending on the game you're playing. But I think the difference between Half-Life 2 and many games that borrow from its playbook is that it doesn't really ever insult the player or talk down. They really leave you alone. And they're not worried about you getting bored. There's no secondary objective in this game. It's always like, go to where we're telling you you need to go. You can search alcoves for items. You can look for hidden spots and stuff like that. But there's no, like, you found one of 100, like, Freeman trophies, you know? There's nothing like that. There's no radio chatter. There's no waypoints. There's no map. Like, just being left alone in a game feels like a luxury now. Just like, there's no tooltips. Just, like, I'm allowed to play in this world, and they trust me that I know what I'm going to do. And how do you guys feel about that? I mean, do you find that is still a luxury? Was it a huge luxury back then? Like, how are games improving or devolving, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I took it for granted at that point. That was just, you know, the idea of someone navigating you live was still pretty novel. Like, oh, Halo did that. That was interesting. But, you know, we weren't to the point where every game does that. So now I play something like Wolfenstein, which is pretty light on that. And it's like, oh, yeah, cool. I get to kind of, you know, figure out how to kill everything and get through the level on my own. That's weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because when I look at 2000 – because this was 2004, of course. The original Far Cry came out in March.
Oh, you're right.
Year.
Yeah.
And it's actually a bit in the Half-Life 2 mold in that sense. So they're obviously games of a particular time. Far Cry doesn't really hold your hand that much either. It became a very different game, obviously, once, you know, at least after Far Cry 2, certainly. But it feels like at that time we were in this transition period where the game is kind of holding your hand, but not. It's still trusting you a lot. And I actually really do think that's a luxury now. There's nothing more annoying to me, for example, than a reminder of something that I know because you've already told it to me 30 times.
Yeah.
And I, by the way, Ubisoft, I'm looking right at you when I say this. Turn off the goddamn things. Anyway.
Yes, so I agree.
You know, after a while, trust me. You know, teach me something and then trust me. You don't have to teach me how to point a gun and shoot it in a game anymore. I already know this stuff. And if you actually have really fantastic level design that I think Half-Life 2 is completely full of fantastic level design. Some people disagree with me on the level design on Half-Life 2. But I treasure that, especially because it really is sort of rare. I get Dark Souls again.
Yeah, so that's
the
true.
Thing that comes to mind. But
it's,
you know,
it's hard to think. I mean, are there other modern examples outside of like Dark Souls that are as trusting with the player? I feel like when Dark Souls came around, it was like a breath of fresh air. We realized what games could be again. Has anything picked up from that? I mean, even I think Dark Souls 2, I don't even know if anyone from Software played Half-Life 2, but I see the same philosophy playing out in Dark Souls where it's like, we'll leave you alone. We trust you, things like that. I mean, can we think of any other modern examples, or is Half-Life and things like Dark Souls, Half-Life, are they just kind of like doing their own thing out in the wilderness?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know. I think like maybe things that Platinum make are typically good about teaching you a thing.
Yeah, and then that's
just,
true.
And then just letting you go. Like I think playing Bayonetta felt sort of like that, a very different type of game obviously, but it certainly didn't feel like it was holding my hand. It felt like it gave me the very basic tools, and then after that I learned how to string them together and how to survive and how to thrive.
I do feel that Platinum is one of the few developers that will trust you and teach you without doing it explicitly. Like they're very good about that.
But in shooters, I mean, Wolfenstein's a great example, I think. But
yeah.
And it still doesn't totally do that. They're still, you know, like a voice in your ear occasionally. And the cutscenes tend to be like explicit cutscenes. They are not immersive the same way that Half-Life is. But yeah, there's still a lot of I don't know. I really like the New Order. I feel like there's a lot of kind of that subtle behind the scenes, can you figure out the story here going on? Some of it's played out a little, spelled out a little too much. But now I can't really think of any shooter right now that is as hands-off, do-your-own-thing as Half-Life 2.
I mean, maybe I'll throw out the original Crysis and Crysis 2 again. Not so much Crysis 3. Again, I think that Crysis 2 might be the closest game. I mean, that game is problematic, don't get me wrong, but I think it's the closest we've really gotten to that kind of experience from sort of a gameplay and a storytelling level. Well, not even really storytelling. It's much more specific and blatant. But there's something about the way it guides you through the spaces without having to be completely, you know, condescending about it. The way it gives you room to maneuver without giving you a completely open world. And so on and so forth. Even vehicle sections that feel sort of similar to Half-Life 2 and break up things in that same way. In particular, the original Crysis's expansion, Crysis Warhead, feels very Half-Life 2 if you go and play it.
I'll have to check
now.
Those games out. I haven't played – I played Far Cry 2, but I know it's a much different game than Far Cry 1.
Very, very different, yeah.
And I have to say, like, playing Half-Life 2 made me play a little bit of Portal last night. And I really, really miss this era of Valve where we had a lot of games borrowing from the Half-Life 2 ethos. We had the episodes, which were not as great, but I still think that they were fun. Left 4 Dead and Left 4 Dead 2, which were very different in terms of how they were playing, but they still used the same visual cues and same storytelling using the assets of the world rather than cutscenes and things like that. And then we have, like, Portal and Portal 2, which I think is just that physics stuff from Half-Life 2 without any of the combat. And I really miss this era of Valve. I don't know if they'll ever return to it. They seem content making their MOBA money and their Team Fortress hat money. Do you guys think Valve is interested in making just a single player experience like Half-Life 2 again, or even like a multiplayer experience like Left 4 Dead? It feels like they are much more into games as like a service rather than just like a release.
Valve offers everyone who works there a lot of freedom to do as they will. So I don't think you can really say Valve collectively feels one way or another. But my suspicion, like I said earlier, is that, you know, Half-Life and Half-Life 2 were such monumental games. I feel like there is a certain level of expectation attached to this game, to the series. I feel like we're not going to see a Half-Life 3 until someone there has the lightning bolt that says, this is what we need to do to make a game that is, again, faithful to what's come before, but still also feels like a momentous move forward for the genre.
Yeah, I mean, Half-Life 3 exists in bits and pieces here and there on Valve's computers. It's all over the place. That's why we get those little pieces, files, and all those things that the internet goes crazy
when Half-Life 2 mysteriously updates, for no reason. You're like, what happened?
I mean, there's certainly – I mean, it clearly – you know, parts of Half-Life 3 exist. You know, the question is, can it be put into – can it be pieced together into something that they actually think is relevant or is good or is fun? And you know, I'd rather not have Half-Life 3 than have bad Half-Life 3, yeah. certainly. And I don't think Valve wants to or is willing to make a game that's not good. And I think it's been a while since Valve itself as a developer has made anything that's not good. And I think they'd rather just not do it than take that chance on something that doesn't meet what their internal expectations are.
At this point, though, do you feel that any ending would be satisfying? I can't imagine an ending to this making sense or making people happy, or I mean, it would be great if it just came to an end and we would just say, okay, this exists now and we can just like move on with our lives. But do you think that, let me see, 11 years later, or maybe 8 years if we're counting the episodes, because that's when episode 2 came out, 2007, is that right?
I think about
so.
Then,
yeah. So like 8 years later, would any finale like satisfy either of you guys? I don't think it would satisfy me. Like I feel like so much time has passed and I don't value the same things I did when I first played Half-Life. Like the story is not super important to me. I just enjoy the moment-to-moment gameplay. And I don't know if how this story wraps up, I even care about it.
I don't know. Like yes, I would say for me, yes. Okay. But maybe that's because this is a series I love and I'm invested in. But even beyond that, I mean, we even see this in shorter time periods now where, hey, enough time passed between Uncharted 1 and Uncharted 2 where Uncharted feels fresh all over again as opposed to Assassin's Creed, which is every year. And so it feels dull and unexciting. Plenty of time has passed for a game that's pretty much like Half-Life 2 to feel fresh as far as I'm concerned. And that's one reason why I play it every year, because it continues to feel fresh to me. As much as we can talk about its influence, games that are just like Half-Life 2, as we mentioned, really just don't exist.
That's
and
true,
in
yeah.
In that sense alone, even if they make something that's structurally more or less just like Half-Life 3, I would be satisfied with that from that perspective.
That's right. I mean, a lot of things borrow from it, but it is wholly unique in how it feels and how it plays and just I don't know, just what it does. Jeremy, how about you? Like, would a finale satisfy you in any way? Or are you invested?
Yeah, I don't think that would be too difficult because I don't have a tremendous attachment to the series. I will play Half-Life 3, whatever form it takes, if it ever takes a form. But I don't have, like, you know, these unreasonable expectations. It's not like, you know, it would be it's going to be interesting to see Star Wars Episode 7 when that comes out, which will already have happened by the time this episode goes live. But like I have a lot invested in that just from having been a fan of those movies for so long and followed that franchise. But Half-Life is like a thing that I play occasionally when the games come out, and then maybe I'll go back and revisit it occasionally. But it's not, you know, it's not something that I'm personally, you know, means all that much to me. So I would be happy to see the, you know, third game come out, wrap up the trilogy, bring it into everything, say, what happens to Earth now that most of the water is gone and all the oceans are full of weird alien fish? Like, there's a lot to kind of clean up there afterwards.
Yeah.
So there's a part of me that's kind of curious to see what the idea for Half-Life beyond the battle with the Combine is, but I wouldn't want them to keep dragging it out. I would like to just see the story come to a finale.
And if any German hackers are listening, you might want to consider hacking Valve and finding Half-Life 3. I'm just kidding. Don't do that. You will get arrested by your government. It happened before, people. So yeah, I will say, yes, play Half-Life 2. You might think an FPS from 11 years ago. Are you kidding me? But no, it's great. My only complaint is that it's a little bit too long, but I mean, you can play it in fits and starts and, you know, you can actually select the chapter you want to play if you want to skip something. So there's always that built into the game too. But Kevin, I assume you would think it holds up as well. I mean, you play it every year.
Oh, yes. I play every year and I think it holds up fantastically. But, I mean, obviously, some things are quaint, like I said before.
Before we go, is there anything that you dislike about the game? I'm just curious. As someone who's so invested in Half-Life 2, is there anything that stands out like, oh, I hate this part. Oh, man, this thing again?
There is that stupid physics puzzle that I really
hate. Oh, yeah, that
hate.
We did breathe it. Yeah.
And I mean, even beyond that, I think there's one danger in this kind of narrative, which is that when every event is really, really important, that really can mess up foreshadowing. So, for example, the whole thing with Judith Mossman kind of doing her you know, sort of, hey, I'm working for Breen. And then at the very last minute, she changes her mind and no, I've decided that I'm going to be a double agent in this scenario. So she's the only character who could possibly have done such a thing.
That's true.
Because there are so few characters.
There are four characters, including right. Gordon, I think.
So, you know, it's one of those things where when you do attach so much storytelling importance to every single detail, it becomes pretty easy to start to piece together where some of those things are going to go. Mm. That's sort of one of my small complaints with the game. And of course, difficulty is sort of an interesting thing because, of course, now that I've played it so many times, but I would say that in terms of most shooters, Half-Life 2 is a relatively easy game, certainly until you get to the end and all hell breaks loose. But for the most part, the shooting is more playground-type shooting than anything where you with a few exceptions, obviously, where you've it's just pretty easy, especially considering you're not a combat-trained,
right.
You know, dude.
You're just an engineer.
But, you know, for the most part, I would say Half-Life 2 is for me, as close to perfect as a shooter can be, even if, you know, a modern shooter doesn't even feel like that. I mean, Half-Life 2 and BioShock feel more like they exist in the same space than, you know, first-person adventures, with guns.
I see that. Well, thanks so much for coming on down to our podcast studio, Kevin. It was great to meet you and great to hear what you hear about what you said, what you think about Half-Life. I'm going through all the verbs I know right now. But as for us, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, and Twitch, and YouTube as Retronauts. Please go to our blog for all kinds of great stuff. Also, with every episode we post a blog post on usgamer.net that tells you what music we use, links to relevant stuff. I'll put the links to Kevin's piece and the last hours of Half-Life 2 in there. And please keep the reviews coming on the iTunes Music Store. They really help the show. It takes a few seconds to write one. And if you do that, it'll increase our visibility and we'll be doing great stuff from here on out. So please do that. And as always, the show is brought to you by Patreon. Go to patreon.com/retronauts. $2 a month can get you in at the lowest tier. And if you give more, you can get some stuff in return. So check it out. And as for me, I am Bob Servo on Twitter. You can also find my work at usgamer.net and Something Awful. And I also do another podcast called Talking Simpsons, which is a chronological Simpsons podcast, a companion piece, if you will. And you can go to lasertimepodcast.com to find that, or just search for Talking Simpsons on whatever device you use. You'll find it. Kevin, you're the guest. Where can we find you? What are you doing these days?
You can find me. If you go to wildguesses.com, you can listen to the podcast that I host, which typically features ex-GameSpotters Tom McShay and Carolyn Pettit, along with other guests that we have along from time to time. And other than that, go play Devillion and Atlas Reactor, I guess.
We'll do. Jeremy?
You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me at usgamer.net as a writer. It's very exciting. And other stuff. I'm on the internet. Look me up.
Cool. Thanks again, everybody. We'll see you next week with a brand new micro episode. Take it easy.